You're listening to All Things Cage at Wave Farms, WGXC 90.7 FM, radio for open ears. I'm your host, Laura Kuhn, director of the John Cage Trust, and my guest tonight is Robert Warby, a composer, sound artist, and broadcaster based in London. Warby's work is rooted in a fascination with sound, its characteristics, its textures, shapes, and patterns. And the idea that when sounds are combined, meaning becomes multifaceted, slippery, and difficult to pin down. These preoccupations inform nearly all of his work and fuel an insatiable curiosity. Warby began his work as a composer and sound artist in the mid-1970s, before the term sound art was in common use, when he made audio pieces, collaborating with experimental filmmakers and performance artists. Toward the end of the 70s, he played guitar and tapes in a post-punk band called The Distributors. Shattered, metallic, dub funk, said the New Musical Express. The band released several singles, recorded two Radio 1 sessions for John Peel, and played regularly with This Heat, The Raincoats, and other seminal bands of that era. In the 1980s, Warby received awards from the Arts Council of Great Britain to work as a composer and undertake a number of residencies. He developed his work with electronic music and presented workshops in all kinds of situations that encouraged people to make music with new technology. At this time, he also worked with the Mekons, a band that achieved considerable success in the USA and Europe. But his career in pop music came to an abrupt halt when, in 1989, he was invited to work with John Cage at the Huddersfield Contemporary Music Festival. Throughout the 1990s, Warby expanded his work in electroacoustic music, focusing particularly on music for contemporary dance. He also continued and developed collaborative work with the video artist Jeremy Welsh, with whom he has been working since the mid-1970s. Their work, which has been shown throughout Europe, in the Americas, and in Australia, continually confronts the dominant received relationship between sound, image, and observer prevalent in popular media. In 1994, he began assisting the composer and writer Michael Nyman, working on several films, concert music, and the opera Facing Goya. In the mid-90s, Warby began broadcasting on BBC Radio 3, presenting a five-part series entitled Cacophony Now that explored how dissonance and noise interface with contemporary music. Since that time, he has become a regular presenter of Here and Now, the BBC's main contemporary music program, and has made several features on subjects including the work of Daphne Oram, the founder of the BBC Radiophonic Workshop, and the music of notorious futurist composer and painter Luigi Russolo. Along with colleagues from the BBC and Sonic Arts Network, Warby founded the Cut and Splice Festival in 2002, which has since grown into an acclaimed international festival of sound art and experimental music presented by Sound and Music and BBC Radio 3. Through the use of obsolete, abandoned technology, Robert's latest works hark back to the earliest days of electronic music making. Recent works have made use of shortwave radio, tape machines, and analog devices like sine wave oscillators. Shape Changer is a sound installation made of discarded hi-fi speakers that is based on the saga of the Viking chronicler Eagle. A collaborative electronic score for the German expressionist film The Cabinet of Dr. Caligari uses sounds found between the stations on the radio dial. And several subsequent pieces used sine wave oscillators that were built for Karlheinz Stockhausen in the early 80s and were discovered languishing in a forgotten cupboard not far from where the radiophonic workshop was once located. Among Warby's most recent endeavors for BBC Radio 3 is Silent Witness, John Cage, Zen, and Japan, a BBC Radio Cumbria production that first aired in 2020, produced by Andrew Carter. So welcome to All Things Cage, Robert. It's great to see you.
Fabulous to be here, Laura. Fabulous.
It took us a while, but we persevered.
Absolutely, absolutely.
I was just reading your bio, your, as you call it, your out-of-date bio. But you say something that I found really interesting. And you said that, I'm going to quote you, you say, but Robert Warby's career in pop music came to an abrupt halt when in 1989, he was invited to work with John Cage at the Huddersfield Contemporary Music Festival.
This is true.
This is marvelous. So well, it is, if you're going to pick one thing to go work with John Cage at, especially in that period in his life, Huddersfield Contemporary Music Festival was probably the best place to do that.
Yeah, so maybe I should fill in a little backstory here.
Please.
I played in a rock band called the Mekons, who were extremely successful in America. You know, like the New York Times sent their one of their correspondents to come and live with us for a week in the city of Leeds in England, so they could write up this whole story about this band, the Mekons. I can't remember how many American tours I did, you know, maybe five or six or whatever it was. Anyway, in 1988, I was in New York with a day off and knew that John's telephone number was in the telephone directory. And in 1987, the year before that, I had formed an ensemble. I'd been asked to put together an ensemble to tour some electronic music in the United Kingdom. And two of the pieces I chose were Fontana Mix and Cartridge Music, simply because they had scores. And I was curious to find out what these pieces would sound like if I started from scratch. I'd heard recordings. I'd heard John's recordings and I'd heard other recordings. And so I made these two new realizations, toured them in 1987 in the United Kingdom. In 1988, I was in New York and I had a day off and I phoned this telephone number that was in the directory. And of course, John picked the phone up.
It was 212-989-7132.
I don't remember that much detail, but that's good. I might use that in something somewhere.
I still have that number. It's associated with the phone that I don't use, but it's a backup phone.
I must get that and use it in a piece or something. Anyway, John picked up the phone and I was just completely, you know, surprised. Anyway, to cut a long story short, I asked, could I come and speak with him about these two pieces, Cartridge Music and Fontana Mix? And he said, yeah, sure, come right over now. And I said, won't I be disturbing you? And he said, I'm disturbed all the time. It won't make any difference. So I immediately left the apartment I was staying in Brooklyn and went to his apartment and spent all afternoon speaking with him, not only about these two pieces, but about just about everything else, anything that John would speak about. So I had met him, you know, I had been to his apartment and I had spoken with him. And then in 1989, the director of the Huddersfield Contemporary Music Festival, Richard Steinitz, asked me, would I be interested in working with John as part of a team to realize a performance of Roratorio? That was going to be the big, big, big piece. And of course, I said yes, but I was double booked because this rock band, the Mekons, were going back to America because we frequently went around October, November time. And it took me about 2 seconds to decide, you know, am I going to go on another tour of America back to those grubby dressing rooms and those same venues that I've played for the last 5 years? Or am I going to work with John Cage for 10 days at the Huddersfield Contemporary Music Festival and see him every day, have lunch, be able to speak with him about all kinds of stuff and work on this performance of Roratorio with him and Jim Fulkerson? So, hey, it was a no-brainer. You know, I decided that I would leave the band. Well, I didn't leave completely. I didn't go on that tour. And I think I played on another couple of records or I did something. But my time with that band was up. I was fed up with rock music. I had this kind of dual career in the early 80s of being in a rock band, which was kind of great fun, as rock bands are, and being a composer and a performer of new music. So my career as a rock musician actually, you know, gradually came to a halt, but the trigger was working with John in 1989.
Right. So you came to this crossroads and you had to make a decision. And yeah. You did.
Yeah, but in a way, I'd kind of come to the decision before that, because I remember being at CBGB's, and I was on stage at CBGB's, and the crowd were going wild. You know, they were just loving us, and it was all going really, really well. And I was playing a little cheap keyboard with mini keys, because I'm not a keyboard player at all. And I was thumping out these chords that I've been playing. This was the end of the tour, and I'd been playing these same chords every night for like 2 weeks or something. Just primary diatonic triads in the key of G, in the key of C, in the key of D. And I was bored. It was like a kind of day job.
Right.
And I thought, it won't be long. We'll be off stage soon. And then I thought, this is crazy. You know, like, I don't like this. I'm not interested in this anymore. So I came off stage at CBGB's, went back to the hotel and did my laundry and listened to Beethoven's Sixth Symphony on a cassette Walkman.
And sounds cathartic.
You know, I don't, in a basement laundry in a grubby hotel somewhere in New York, you know. So I'd kind of decided that I was fed up with all that anyway. I'd done this tour, you know, I'd realized Fontana Mix and I'd realized Cartridge Music. And I'd then spent a whole afternoon speaking with John about it. And there were other things to do. There were just other things to do.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, well, I'm glad you did give me that backstory, because the way it reads, it's as if you had some revelation while you were working with Cage in Huddersfield that made you say, I'm not going to do popular music anymore. But this was kind of brewing for you. And you also, that statement led me to a lot of questions for you. Now I have new questions, but the older questions were, you know, did you have a specific goal at Huddersfield? Were there particular things that you were being brought in for?
Yes, there were. There were two main things. One was to assist on this performance, realization and performance of Roratorio. And the other was to do with a kind of outreach education project, because there was a local technical college in Huddersfield where young students who were maybe 18 or 19 years old were preparing maybe to go to a conservatoire, yeah, to the Royal Academy of Music or the Royal Manchester College of Music or whatever it was.
Right.
And I was brought in to introduce them to Roratorio for them to make a student performance. This was a thing that was going on in parallel with the festival. You know, they do these outreach education projects with students and primary school children and, you know, the public in general.
Right. Now, Robert, let me interrupt you very quickly. When you say to do their own realization, are you talking about start to finish, meaning they choose a book, they do the poetry form? Okay. So yep.
The whole
thing. Nice.
The whole thing. So, of course, when I got to the technical college and met the students, I realized that they'd only ever heard the name John Cage. They didn't know anything about him at all. So the first thing I did is a performance of 4 minutes, 33 seconds, which turned out to be 2 minutes, 26 seconds, using the instrument I played was a Spanish classical guitar, because that's the instrument I played when I was a music student.
Okay.
So I did this performance and the students sat there and shuffled and giggled and, you know, all the usual kind of that's how I started with them, introducing this idea of John's music. And these students, you have to remember, they played in brass bands. You know, brass bands are a very English phenomenon.
We have them too. We have them too.
In Yorkshire, you know, they have a particular kind of repertoire and a whole tradition. And they were also students of Gilbert and Sullivan operas and stuff like that. And so this whole thing with John was, John's music was just utterly baffling for them, utterly baffling.
And how old are these kids? I mean, roughly.
18.
Oh,
18.
Oh, 18. Okay.
18, so 19.
Not little kids.
No, 18, 19. They were proficient musicians. They could play their instruments. They could sing. And they liked performing in amateur orchestras and, you know, playing in the brass bands and doing all that kind of stuff. And so we didn't actually take a book. We took a text, and the text was the local newspaper, the Huddersfield Daily Examiner. Okay. So we took this newspaper. That was the text. And the music that they chose was brass band music and Gilbert and Sullivan, the kind of stuff that they knew. And they worked pretty hard, but they were just confused all the time. You know, it was just very, very difficult. You know, they would ask me questions about it, and I could answer them. But I kept saying to them, look, in a few weeks, John is going to be here. So you are going to meet him. He's going to come here to the college. You're going to meet him. And all these questions that you're asking me, I can answer them. I can tell you what I think. But it sounds to me like you want to speak to the composer. And you will be able to do that. And I now realize that, or I then realize that that was a bit like saying, well, next week Beethoven's coming to visit and you're going to be able to ask him about the Fifth Symphony or something. Right. And they didn't really get it, that there was this composer, you know, that he was alive and that he was coming to Huddersfield and he'd written this extraordinarily strange piece as far as I was concerned. But yeah. They were committed and I put, you know, I worked with them and they made their realization and they followed the score. Because one of the great things about John's scores is you know exactly what you have to do.
Right. It's very, they're very task driven.
Absolutely. So, you know, you may have a stopwatch or you may have some other cue or whatever it is. And you know exactly what you're going to do, just as you would if you're playing in a brass band or a Beethoven string quartet or you're singing in a choir. You know when you've got to start, you know when you've got to stop, and you know what you've got to do. So they'd done all that. And then I'd rehearsed them and got them, you know, got them pretty good. And then John arrived in Huddersfield. And then, you know, I was working with these students one morning. And then suddenly John walked in to this rehearsal space in the college, you know, in denim jacket and jeans. This old man came into the room and he caught my eye and I said, oh, hi, John. And he said, oh, hi, Robert. I don't have anything to do this morning. I know this rehearsal isn't scheduled for me to be here, but I just thought I'd drop by, you know, I'd come in. And I looked at the students who looked at this old man. And I looked at John and I looked at the students and I said, okay, folks, this is John Cage. And there was this incredible silence of like jaw dropping. What? Who is this guy? This guy is in these denim clothes and he doesn't look glamorous. He doesn't look like he's just come off the television.
Right.
He's some old guy, you know, like what is this? There was this long silence and he said, don't let me interrupt you. I'll just go and sit over here and you carry on, you know, with what you're doing. Because he didn't want to interrupt the rehearsal, which is very important. So I said to the students, I said, okay, we're going to carry on working. John is sat over there. You've been asking me these questions for the last 5 weeks. Go and ask John. He's sitting there. You can go and speak with him. But we're going to continue rehearsing. If you find you've got nothing to do for a minute or two, just go and converse with him. And they did. It took a while, but gradually one, you know, they'd go across and speak with him. And I could see they had the score and they were asking him questions and he was talking with them. And I just left them alone. I didn't actually intervene in any kind of way. They can speak with John. John can speak with them, you know.
Right.
And it was a great success. And I'd said to them, look, when we've done this performance in the Huddersfield Town Hall, and you've been there, yeah, you know what this space is like.
Sure.
And it was a public performance in the afternoon. I said, we're going to have this session. And John and I will sit at the front. And you all sit, you know, facing us. And then you can ask him absolutely any questions about anything at all that you like, anything. And they were all really apprehensive because they had a huge amount of respect for him because he was a composer. Yeah. And he'd written this piece and they were kind of doing this work and stuff. So I said, look, what we'll do is this. You can do it all anonymously. You write your questions anonymously on a piece of paper. We'll fold up the piece of paper. And I took my grandfather's bowler hat along for that day. I put all the questions in the bowler hat. John and I sat there. And John picked out the first question from the bowler hat. And the first question was, why don't you write proper music? That was the first question.
Yeah.
And I didn't speak. I just read the question out, you know. And I turned to John and he eloquently described what it was that he was trying to do and why it was proper music. And then there was another question that came out of the hat. And after like two or three questions, we didn't need the hat anymore because the conversation just opened wide, you know, completely.
Right.
For about an hour, you know, for about an hour, we spoke about not only John and his music, but music in general, the all, you know, the whole thing. And right at the very end, he turned to the students and he said, don't pay any attention to anything I have to say unless it's going to be of use to you.
Lovely.
Which I thought was tremendous.
Yeah, yeah. So they probably fell in love at that point.
They did. And they all came to the performance of Roratorio with the Chieftains and John. And my team, you know, the team with whom I was working, because we set up the loud, you know, we set up 16 channel loudspeaker system with 16 track tape, all that stuff. And the students were all there and they all came to me and said, they thanked me. And they said, if we hadn't done our own realization of this piece, we just wouldn't have really grasped what this was about. And this is one of the most amazing pieces of music we've ever experienced. And it was about an hour long performance of Roratorio in the Huddersfield Town Hall.
Right, right, right. With all the original players.
With all the original players, apart from the vocalist who died, Paddy, I can't remember his surname, but we had his voice on tape. We had his singing on tape.
That wasn't Glacken, was it?
I can't remember. I can't. It's a long time ago.
There were two. There were two Paddies. There was Paddy Glacken and Paddy. I'm never going to remember his name.
No, but we had him on tape. So you know, we his voice did feature in the piece.
So I'm dying of curiosity. So you say that the kids didn't choose a book, which is a little harder now to realize something without the book, because the book, just like Roratorio, Finnegan's Wake, James Joyce, gives you a theme. It gives you a kind of thematic tone. What did they title their work, for example?
They titled it Roratorio. I don't have the score in front of me, but the title of the piece is Roratorio. Roratorio comes from an Irish circus on Finnegan's Wake.
Right. What did they title there?
I can't remember, but it was... They didn't title it an Irish circus, but a Yorkshire circus on the Huddersfield Daily Examiner or something of that kind. Right.
But you don't remember the title. Like Cages and Roratorio.
I must have it written down somewhere. But they took... And the theme, of course, was generated by the material that was in the newspaper. Mm-hmm. So there were lots of local stories. And when we made the recordings, you know, John had gone to Ireland and recorded all the locations of Finnegan's Wake. We made multiple recordings of all the places mentioned in the Huddersfield Daily Examiner. So and it was extremely appropriate because it was very local.
Yes, yeah. No, I think local. It sounds fascinating. I would love to think of a title for this.
the students did, you know, they followed the score, they found the title. And I must have that written down somewhere. I will have that.
I'm curious.
Have documentation.
Yeah, drop me a note if you ever come across it.
I will, I will.
Yeah, so, you know, there's no better way, is there, to understand something than to do it yourself.
Exactly.
You know, project-based learning is so useful to people.
Yeah, I mean, you can read about it all you like, but I mean, and listen to the records or whatever, but if you're actually engaged in the music making.
Then
that's the way to get involved, isn't it?
So their piece was performed as part of the Huddersfield, that was the 11th festival, I think, that year.
Yep.
Did they perform?
Yes, they did. They were the performer. In an afternoon in the town hall, and the public came, you know, so there were actually two performances of Roratorio at that festival. Uh-huh. Two performances of that piece at the festival. One was entitled Roratorio, John's realization of his own piece, and the other was the piece that was performed by the students of the Huddersfield Technical College.
Right, right. So you know, that particular Huddersfield Festival, and I was amazed. I know that you worked with him during that festival. I did some research on it. I mean, I knew that it was it was special in the sense that, you know, Cage was the composer in residence and he was there with Messiaen and Pierre Boulez. It was a very big deal that his
It was a very big deal.
Yeah.
Not least because John and Pierre Boulez hadn't spoken to each other in 40 years.
Exactly. Exactly. I remember when he went. I mean, it was a very, very big deal. And also the players, you had the creme de la creme of players at the time. You had, you know, Arditi, you had Margaret Lang Tan, you had Robert Black was there. Yep. It was amazing the number of performers that were there that had
That's the Huddersfield Festival. You know, the players are the very, very best. It's probably, I would say it's probably the best music, contemporary music festival in the world, but I wouldn't know because I haven't been to them all. I've never been to Tanglewood, for example, or any of those.
Yeah. No, but festivals. It's definitely, that was definitely a place to break your pop music habit of going to America and playing in these little clubs to, you know, to go hang out in Huddersfield with Cage at such an auspicious place where you're really going to hear things. Do you remember, Robert? I mean, one of the other questions I was going to ask you, but now I think it's moot. And that question was, how much did you know about Cage before you went to work with him at Huddersfield?
Quite a lot. But I realize now, however many years later, that I knew almost nothing.
Really?
And when I went to see him in 1988, I'd spent about 3 months realizing Fontana Mix, because that piece takes a long time to work. And same with Cartridge Music. And actually, I have a story about Fontana Mix, because it was performed at Huddersfield by an ensemble, the name of which I can't remember. And John and I were sat in St. Paul's Hall, at the back of St. Paul's Hall in Huddersfield, just he and I discussing this student project. Yeah, and we'd been to a concert, a lunchtime concert. The audience had left and John and I were just sat there. And one of the people who are going to perform Fontana Mix, and they brought the score. They kind of approached John. He approached John with the score, and he said to John, "I don't really know what to do with this." And the performance was the day after. I remember once, Laura, you and I were at a big Cage event at the Barbican, and there were some I'm sorry to say, there were some performances that were not really up to scratch.
I think that was a music circus, was it not?
I can't remember what it was. Well, I do remember, but I'm not going to say what it was. I'm going to be discreet here.
Okay.
And anyway, these performances were, well, I'll be honest, atrocious. They were absolutely atrocious. And you and I, we weren't sat together, but we scurried out of the concert hall before the applause started, and I saw you, and you were ashen-faced. Your face was absolutely white. And I said, "Laura, what's the matter? What's the matter?" And you said, "Robert, you know, the Europeans, they don't trust the material."
Uh-huh.
Is what you said.
Mm-hmm.
And this guy had got this copy of Fontana Mix, and he was asking John, what should I do about it? And he was going to perform it the day after. Now, come on, Fontana Mix, the score of Fontana Mix is very clear. It tells you what to do to make a realization, and you do it, and the piece works.
And you don't do it overnight.
It took me 3 months.
Exactly. I mean, it's not something that you can just, you know, pick up.
So every realization of Fontana Mix I've done, and I've done about two or three, has taken me about 3 months.
Right.
And so John, I thought, oh my God, you know, this guy hasn't got a clue. And John is sitting here. What's he feeling about this? And John was extremely diplomatic, as he always was, and very good at dealing with these situations. And he said, "I'm terribly sorry. I wrote that piece 30 years ago and I don't really remember, I wrote it in Milan in Italy, and I was working in Berio Studio, but I don't remember the details. And I do know that you need to spend some time with the with the transparent sheets layering." And this guy hadn't hadn't actually looked at the score. You know, he thought maybe he could sight read this or something.
You know, Robert, it isn't just the pieces that require a real understanding of the process, the things that you have to do, a technological understanding of what you have to do. It isn't just that, because I've been to performances where I've sat through, suffered through really, really good ensembles who are going to play Cage. One in particular comes to mind. It was the Aircom ensemble.
Oh, yeah.
And they were parsing out into small groups and playing Cage. And one little group played string quartet in four parts.
Yeah.
And it was so awful, their performance of it, because they hadn't even looked at it. You know that they thought and said, oh, it's Cage. We don't need to rehearse this. You know, we have to pay attention to the other things that require it. And it was sloggy. The tempo was when it got to the da 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 da. It was like da 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 da. It was just awful. And when I remember leaving the hall and I walked by, the person who was sitting behind me was behind me as we were walking out of the hall. And this person said something like, that was the most beautiful work I've ever heard. And I turned around and looked at him and I said, you should hear it played right.
Hear it played well.
Because it was so awful. So it isn't just those pieces that require so much learning.
Yes.
Like Fontana Mix.
Commitment, I would say. Commitment. Yeah. John, and all good music requires commitment. So to come back to your question about what I knew, I certainly knew Fontana Mix because I'd made this realization. And I knew something about cartridge music because I'd made the realization. And I had been, by that time in 1999, I'd been to performances of Cage and I had a collection of LP records and I'd done a huge amount of reading. And one of the books that really helped me was Michael Nyman's book on experimental music.
It's a great book.
Michael, I became a student of Michael's, but not an official student. He was teaching in an art school in the town of Nottingham in the Midlands here in England. And I gate crashed his class basically and became a student, you know, and because I'd read his book. And of course, Michael helped me a lot with my coming to terms with Cage. And I'd met John before 88 when I went to his hotel, when I went to his apartment, sorry. I'd met him here in London, and again, I gate crashed. I went to a performance with the Merce Cunningham Dance Company, and John was performing Inlets. And I just went backstage, you know, after the concert, and John was drinking Glenfiddich whiskey out of an earthenware mug. And he was just stood there by himself. And I said, you know, I just walked up and introduced myself and said how much I'd enjoyed the performance. And he said, do you know Glenfiddich whiskey? It's just like it's just like spring water. Try this. He handed me the mug and I drank a bit. And then we got talking and he said, oh, there's a party in St. John's Wood. You must come. And I was just completely taken aback because, you know, they say you should never meet your heroes and all that kind of stuff. And here was this guy inviting me to a party. He gave me an address and I just made my way up there. And the door opened and these two very large ladies, Americans, very overdressed with a lot of jewelry, invited me into this huge house in St. John's Wood and welcomed me as if they'd known me all their lives. And I was introduced to people. And then John and Merce arrived with their wicker baskets with the macrobiotic food. So I had spoken with John, you know, and of course, you know, I was just asking him those idiotic, banal questions that people ask him all the time who know nothing about his work. But his being so incredibly generous and personable just answered the questions. You know, he must have answered them a million times. And now I know that that was the case. And I understood, I think at the time, I appreciated his generosity, but I didn't appreciate the depth of his generosity. You know, I knew I wasn't asking these questions for the first time, that he'd been asked this before, but it was from my perspective, I suppose. And
right.
And now when I think back, I'm really embarrassed. You know, when I think back, because I have a recording of my visit to his apartment in 1988, which I used in the documentary that I made for BBC Radio 3 with the producer Andrew Carter. And I listening back to that recording is just so embarrassing.
Painful, painful.
My questions are so banal, you know, and like idiotic. And now, you know, if only I could speak with him now, you know, to even on the same topics, you know, it would be completely different.
Of course, of course, of course. Jeez. You poor thing. I was with him once in Australia. And somebody was sitting in the audience and they were doing a Q&A with him. And somebody asked him, you know, some inane question, some question that he'd been asked a million times. And he said, he just looked at this woman and he said, how long does it take a letter to arrive in Australia from America? And she was quite taken aback. And she said, I don't know, a week, 2 weeks? And he said, huh. He said, how long does it take an idea to get here? I don't think she understood him. I really don't.
That's a put down. That's a pretty good put
totally,
down.
Totally.
But it's like, so cleverly done and without malice.
Yes, I don't think she understood it as a put down.
No, but it's not malicious and it's not really nasty. You know, he's just asking a question, of course. He's not attacking her in any kind of way. He's just asking a question.
Yes, of course. You know, people, you know, like to, for a period, it's not so much this way anymore, but for a period, the primary question that would come up when people found out that I worked with Cage and they would want to talk about his sexual proclivities. And I honestly could answer, and still to this day answer, that I think that Cage was in love with intelligence. You know, it didn't matter if you had certain body parts, you know, it really didn't. He just loved intelligent people. So it didn't matter if your questions, Robert, were stupid. He knew you were an intelligent person. No, he knew that you were an intelligent person.
He didn't throw me out of the apartment. You know, he didn't throw me out after about 10 minutes, you know. And in fact, Merce came home from a tour of France. And John said, oh, I need to let you know that Merce Cunningham, who also lives here, is what he said. Merce Cunningham, who also lives here, will be returning from France in maybe about half an hour. And we may have to go into the other room.
Right, right.
And I thought, oh, if Merce is coming home, I better leave. And he said, no, fine, you know, it's fine. Merce did come home. And he was pleased to see me. But I did say to him, I'm leaving.
Right, right.
I'm leaving. And he took photographs of me and John. I asked him, would he take a photograph? And he did. And the cats were playing around and, you know.
Of course. He didn't like people to be home when he got home.
No. The guy had been on tour in France for about 2 weeks.
Exactly.
You know?
Exactly.
And he just wants to come home and have a cup of tea or something.
Yes.
And there's some young guy kind of talking rubbish in his apartment. You
know? Right. It happened all the time.
Time. I'm glad to know that, Laura. I'm so glad to know that.
No, I mean, I couldn't go to work in the morning. John, you know, was an early riser. He always worked. He was constant.
Yeah.
And I was scheduled to be there, you know, at 9 o'clock if Merce was on tour. If Merce was home, I couldn't come till 10.
Yeah.
And even then, I was inclined sometimes to stand outside the front door watching for him to come out and, you know, hiding behind the corner so I could go out
and do class or whatever he was doing. Yeah, indeed. Yeah.
So anyway, so go back to Huddersfield for a second. I'm really curious. So you were exposed to a lot of different kind of music of Cage's in Huddersfield. Were there surprises?
Yeah, the number pieces, the string quartets that I'd only read about, I hadn't heard, which of course I thought were exquisitely beautiful. And there was an article in the Guardian newspaper just before the festival, a kind of feature on Cage that was publicizing the festival. And he, in this article, he spoke about harmony. And he mentioned James Tenney.
Right.
I didn't really know who James Tenney was in 1989. And I was just astounded, you know, that John had made this kind of statement about harmony. Here's the man who had said, you know, anybody who wants to learn the rules of harmony can learn them in about 20 minutes and the rest is detail kind of thing. Which I agreed with. Right. Yeah, I thought, yeah, I get that. Yep, yeah, it's true. And this idea of the simultaneity of pitches in a particular way that didn't adhere to rules, you know, and I thought, what does this signify? You know, here's this guy, he's coming towards the end of his life. It's, you know, and he's returning to the use of pitch, you know, and you think about the early pieces, the way he used pitches in the early pieces, particularly things like the string quartet in four parts, absolutely amazing the way he used pitch in that. Yeah. I am just astounded by that piece. So he always had this incredible inventiveness. I always found his inventiveness to be so incredibly inspiring and overwhelming. How could he find a new way to work with pitch? You know, the idea of time brackets. And he told me about the time brackets in 1988. And he told me that's what he was doing. Because I asked him, what are you doing? Tell me about, you know, and he told me, and I didn't really get it. You know, I didn't really know what he was talking about.
Right.
I knew about the number pieces, but I didn't really understand this concept. And then, of course, you know, seeing the scores and hearing the performances in Huddersfield, that was a real revelation, you know, this incredible new
I remember that was
man.
The where the Arditi quartet did four for the first time.
Yes, indeed.
Yes, that's right. And that's exactly. An exquisite piece where they're trading their parts.
And the other thing that was interesting at that time was to hear John's music in concerts with other people's music. So for example, we heard was it Jonathan Harvey's second string quartet in that same concert? I can't remember. But at that time, you know, I heard Jonathan Harvey's piece, which was amazing, absolutely beautiful writing, amazing writing for the cello. And Jonathan then told me he was a cellist. So that's how that worked. And then, of course, Pierre Boulez came in the second weekend. So we had all of this stuff, material of John's in the first half of the festival and Pierre's music in the second half of the festival. And, you know, to hear this champion of the American experimental tradition and the European avant-garde tradition within a period of 10 days was absolutely amazing. And to crown it all at the very end, Olivia Messiaen and Yvonne Laurier over there. So
right. Right.
At the end of the festival, I found myself in an oak paneled room in the town hall with the mayor of Huddersfield, who really didn't have a clue what any of this was about, but he was just putting in his appearance with his gold chain and his gown and all the, you know, all the glitterati of the new music scene, publishers and performers and other composers. And there I was in this oak panel room having a cup of tea with John Cage and Pierre Boulez and Olivia Messiaen.
Right.
And it's interesting. Here's something that really demonstrates the difference in thinking and the mindset of these two men. John introduced me to Pierre Boulez, who I hadn't met. And he very kindly said to Pierre, Robert's been doing some amazing work here, which was very, very generous. And Pierre looked at me and he said, oh, what have you been doing? And I said, I've been working with students on a realization of John's Ruratorio. And I think I was involved. Oh yeah, I was also involved in another project with electronic music. So this is a long time ago with students. These were younger students devising their own electronic music pieces, you know, in very early days of those resources being available to schools. These were kids in high school, yeah?
Yeah.
So, and Pierre looked at me quizzically, you know, like, what are you talking about? And I said, our starting point is the idea that anybody can be a composer. I said, it doesn't mean that everybody wants to be a composer, and it doesn't mean everybody's a good composer. But just as school children are encouraged to write a story or a poem or paint a picture, why should they not be encouraged to compose their own music. And he looked at me quizzically again, and maybe a bit angry. And he said, I don't think this is any, I don't think this is very interesting. And he walked away. And John looked at me, shrugged his shoulders and said, that's Pierre.
That's right.
And the problem was, I think maybe Boulez felt threatened by the idea that anybody could be a composer.
Yeah.
Because being a composer was so important to him, and he came from this tradition that goes back to the Renaissance. And he was a brilliant composer and a brilliant performer and a brilliant musician. The idea that anybody could be involved in this was alien to him.
Right.
But
right.
Since that time, I've been to IRCAM, and I've been to workshops where primary school children aged about 8 are involved in electronic music making.
Right, right.
But in 1989, this was pretty unusual. Hmm. This was not commonplace, the idea right. that anybody could be a composer and, you know.
Right. Well, electronics changed everything, you know, didn't it?
Yeah. Yeah, sure. But it was the intellectual idea for Boulez, right. I think.
Of course.
You know, that anybody could do this, and they can be engaged with composing. Mm-hmm. There are ways of doing it. It doesn't mean you're going to sound like Beethoven or Mozart or Boulez. Yeah, or even Cage. You know, you can use John's techniques, but you're not going to sound, you know, the piece isn't going to sound like something that he's done.
No, I get it. I do.
You know, and so Pierre was a little bit put out by this. You know, it's not what he wanted to hear.
Yeah.
You know, and
he was also put out by Cage's use of chants. You know,
of course, really, no different. But come on, that was the first time they'd met in 40 years.
I know.
You know, we didn't know what was going to happen. We didn't know where the Boulez would snub Cage, you know, and just walk away from him, or what would happen. They seemed to be getting on very well. And they had met on the Friday, and this was the Sunday. They had met. Boulez had arrived late from London with Olivier Messiaen and Yvonne Loriot. He'd been driven up. And George Benjamin did an interview with Pierre in the St. Paul's Hall. And Pierre had been told that John was in the audience, and he acknowledged that publicly. And after the interview, John walked down that, you know, those steep, you know, the auditorium is raked. It's a raked auditorium. And John walked down, and it was like the kind of parting of the Red Sea or something. The people just moved aside, and John went up to Pierre with that huge grin that goes from ear to ear and said, Pierre, my friend, I haven't seen you in 40 years. And they embraced, and we all breathed a huge sigh of relief. You know, we didn't know what would occur. So they had met. And then in the town hall on the Sunday, after this big BBC Symphony Orchestra concert with Pierre conducting, big new piece by Messiaen, we left them alone. They were together. They were together, and they were giggling, you know, and I could hear John speaking French, and I could hear Pierre speaking English, and they were just reminiscing and telling stories. And I just, you know, I just wish I could hear it, but nobody wanted to intrude. You know, this was a private thing in public.
Sure.
And they were very close together. You know, they had been very, very close, those two men.
Yeah. It's lovely.
And, you know, they had been very close, and really all was forgiven and forgotten. You know, the big arguments about chance operations and the big fallings out and all of that were forgiven. And then John went off, you know, John went off to London. He was leaving the festival that day. I actually said to him, I suddenly realized that John was exactly twice my age. And you're leaving now. I don't know when I'm going to see you again. And we've worked together for 10 days and we've had a great time here. What have you got to say to a young man who's half your age? And he said, Robert, get out of whatever cage you happen to be in.
Robert, we have to stop if we're going to play any music.
Okay. Yeah, well, both you and I just talk forever.
I know. We could do this. We could do, you know, the Laura and Robert show once a week for a few months.
And keep talking about John. So why don't we look? So I think it was 2015, I made this CD with the ensemble with whom I worked, the Langham Research Center. We made this CD called John Cage, Early Electronic and Tape Music, another realization of Fontana Mix, this time with Aria, that we made for this.
Oh, nice, nice.
So
okay.
we could play that. The songbooks I recorded in 2012 with Laurie Lixenberg and Gregory Rose.
I remember it's Gregory Rose's idea. CD. Yeah.
Yeah, it's Gregory's idea. And we recorded, he made the point that all the solos for voice hadn't been recorded, not, you know, in one place.
That's correct. That's
so
correct.
We made this. So we could play something off this CD. It depends how much time you have, Laura.
Exactly. Well, if we keep this up, we're going to have about 4 minutes. So I'm going to bid you adieu.
It's been fantastic speaking with you and to have this opportunity to revisit those times that I spent with John Cage.
It's also just lovely for me, and I'm sure the audience, listening audience, just to listen to you remembering Huddersfield, you know, so long ago. So thank you for sharing all of your thoughts.
Thank you, Laura. Okay, thank you very much. And thanks
I'll be
to
in
John
touch.
Cage.
And I'm going to use chance operations on the two CDs to see what we come up with.
Absolutely. Thank you very much.
Yep. Take care, kiddo.
Bye.
Bye. Well, chance has spoken, and we'll listen now to selections only from John Cage songbooks from 2012 with Laurie Lixenberg and Gregory Rose. Released on the Sub Rosa label, which is one of my very favorite Cage recordings. I'll think to do a separate program in the near future on the other CD, John Cage Early Electronic and Tape Music from 2014, also from Sub Rosa. As Robert intimated, John Cage Songbooks is the only recording available on which all of the solos from Cage's songbooks can be heard. 14 solos on their own and 7 mixes, which range from 5 superimposed solos to 18. We don't have time for the mixes, but we do have time to listen to 3 of the solos that are presented on their own. Solo number 4, solo number 90, and solo number 21. In that order, all gorgeous. I might note that while the mixes intermingle the solos on the CD, all of the solos, however they appear on the CD, are available as separate downloads on the Sub Rosa website, which is subrosa.net.
The swan bright oak on the meadow, which was blown down in the spring, is still alive, as if it had been supported by the sap in its trunk. The dirt still which are the colour of an elephant skin. So the Ardea minor walking along the shore like a hen with long legs. Its pants of milk so like and shore, amid which it holds its head erect to watch the bus. That is, it is difficult to discern it. You can get very near, for it is unwilling to fly. Hide among the weeds, the lower pods of the willows and the button bushes are plagued with the capillaries. Gold, etc. Oh.
Richard. Oh,